Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The Big Sister Hotline is recorded on the stolen lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Sovereignty of these lands has never been ceded. I pay my respects to elders past and present. The Hotline is proud to be an ongoing supporter of JIRA, an Aboriginal-controlled community organisation where culture is shared and celebrated. This land always was and always will be Aboriginal, and Black Lives Matter.
Big Sister Hotline, how can we help?
Hello guys, gals and non-binary pals. You're listening to the Big Sister Hotline with me, your host, Clementine Ford, the author of the books Fight Like a Girl and Boys Will Be Boys and the forthcoming memoir How We Love, which is out in October. I have to apologise because I drank an extraordinary amount of wine last night and I'm feeling pretty rough. But I'm here today with my beautiful friend Ada Conroy, who I'm going to talk to about Ada's work. Ada works in women's health and violence prevention. She's fascinating. She's doing really important work. And we are also big Buffy fans and have struggled with the fallout of what that means. We're going to get into that though. Ada, welcome. Welcome Thanks. To the hotline. I think that's the least professional intro I've ever done, but you know, I'm just going to push through. How are you?
I'm good. I'm not hungover, thankfully.
Lucky you. I should say as well for people listening, I'm sitting here with you in your kitchen. Normally I record in my kitchen, but we're in your kitchen today. In your beautiful retro house that I walked into and was like immediately wanted to live in. So many plants, all of that great like 1970s Australian kind of architecture. Do you just love living here? Does it make you happy?
It's absolutely glorious. And I guess I've been, you know, working from home for the past year and really quite happy about it, because it's just one of those really beautiful, you know, reservoir houses that hasn't been renovated. And so, yeah, we're really happy. It's gorgeous.
It makes me so happy to know as well that knowing the work that you do, that you have this space to come back to where you can, you know, the windows are open, the air's flowing through. Like it's not that I know a lot about this stuff and it might sound a bit woo to some people, but it's got a really good energy flow through the house. Yeah. So let's talk about the work that you do.
So I've been working in the family violence sector for just over two decades. And so most of that time, so, you know, working with victim survivors at what we'd call the pointy end. So working in crisis, refuge, counselling, casework, outreach. And then after my daughter was born she's 12 now, but probably when she was about one, I started working as a family violence trainer. And then working in men's behaviour change, so working with male perpetrators of family violence. And I stopped doing that a couple of years ago, but I now train people in how to, I guess, resist colluding with men's violence and with men's sexism and, you know, sense of entitlement over women.
Okay, I'm going to get to that in just a minute, because I found out yesterday that you were doing that training now and it's really interesting. But I just want to go back to your experiences of working with male perpetrators of violence, because you ran a lot of men's behavioural change programs. And can you tell listeners what that entails and, you know, the efficacy of it as well?
Yeah, right. So I'll start with the efficacy, because that's the question that people ask constantly. The trick to it is that they need to want to do the work, because we can't replicate power over somebody who's using power over. It doesn't work, which is why, you know, part of the reason why we also sort of advocate for, you know, prison abolition and prevention instead of punishment, because punishments don't work for perpetrators of family violence because punitive responses are just actually ineffective. So in men's behaviour change, it's most of it is community-based men's behaviour change. And you can tell by what it's called that it's focusing specifically on the behaviour. And so we do this wonderful thing where we separate the person from their behaviour and actually just focus on what they're choosing to do and the impact of that rather than the intention of it, which is a fantastic perspective that's very led by victim survivors and really centralises victim survivors' experiences. And so in terms of what the research tells us about the efficacy of it, you know, as I said, they have to want to change. And if they want to do the work, we've got the right framework for them to work within. And so, yeah, and partly it's up to us to get them to that point of wanting to change. And the way that I think about it is, you know, if you're going to bang your head against a brick wall, which is often how it feels, at least bang your head where there's a crack. And so what that means for us in the work is that we need to find the crack.
That's really, really interesting way of putting it. It must be so, I mean, how do you switch off at the end of the day? Because I know you don't do the men's behavioural change anymore, but you're still working in a similar field. To do that work day in and day out and to see, and I know that this is true for so many people who work in violence prevention and in you know, men's violence particularly, that it does feel like just a slow trickle of change. And I think that must be enormously frustrating because you are making a difference, but it's happening at a glacial pace. Or does it feel that way?
It kind of depends. And I don't know that I think about it like that, to be honest. Like, I sort of think that we're planting seeds to a forest we, you know, are not necessarily going to be spending time in later.
Oh, so that's another great way to put it as well.
Yeah, you kind of have to feel that way, really. Like, if we get invested in one man's individual change process, then we're in trouble.
If you're hearing any little tip tap taps out there in listener land, that's Ada's cat.
It's one of them.
Walking all over the kitchen table. I really love that, you know, that you're planting seeds in a forest that you may not get to spend time in. And that can be applied to so many different things. I often use the analogy when talking about gender equality or gender equity and the work that anyone is doing in that field, that we're baking a cake, you know, it's a similar kind of concept. You're baking a cake and we may be at steps 3 and 4 of a 16-step cake baking process that, you know, maybe this cake takes 150 years to bake and we won't actually get to taste it at the end, but it can't have been made
exactly
without the work that we're doing now.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's really important to remember, because that just reminds me that we're on the shoulders of, you know, so many, mostly women, particularly in the context of family violence work, you know, who have done amazing things and have really, really set the scene for us to pick up on that. The other thing I want to say in terms of the, you know, it feeling incredibly difficult at the end of the day is, you know, the past couple of years, I've started to focus less on vicarious trauma and more on vicarious resilience. And so really thinking about, you know, wherever there is oppression, there is resistance. And when we focus on that resistance and the strength and survival of victim survivors, like with any marginalised communities, we're much more likely to feel resilient in the work and much more likely to be sustained. And I think for me, whenever anybody says, you know, that must be incredibly difficult work, I often say it's not the work itself that's difficult, it's the structures and systems that cause the problems in the first place. So, you know, working with victim survivors or working for victim survivors through those perpetrators is a really good reminder, I think, that we are working with a lot of just a lot of survival. And that focusing on that instead of, you know, not that we're not addressing the trauma, but focusing on that instead of the devastation can really make a big difference to how it feels and the longevity, I think, of the work for all of us.
That's really good advice as well for anyone, even if they're not obviously working specifically in this field, but just anyone who feels like they're part of some kind of resistance or struggle, and sort of struggles as we all do with that sense of feeling demoralized or like nothing's changing, or at the end of the day, the structures are too powerful to dismantle, to focus on that resilience instead of, and to focus on the legacy of people who've come before you and the legacy that you're still continuing to contribute to and create.
Yep.
Is a really kind of healing mechanism, isn't it?
It absolutely can be. And I think just, it's not to say that the work doesn't have an enormous impact or there's not a personal cost, but it doesn't have to destroy us. Mm. And so, yeah, I think that's why focusing on that, the resilience of humans can be really, and also, you know, really believing that people can change, which is, can sometimes feel really difficult to hold on to that belief. You know, when you, for me, you know, sitting in a room full of 15 men who have quite intentionally and deliberately harmed their partners, women and children in their lives, you know, you can sort of lose a bit of hope, but then you might see something, you might see one of them sort of realise something, or, you know, they hear something from you that they've never heard before, and it's just slightly, it shifts their viewpoint.
Mm. Has it increased your empathy?
For?
Well, I guess it's a tricky question and it's an uncomfortable sort of thing to discuss, but one thing that I struggle with a little bit myself now, particularly since having a child who is a boy, is looking at men who perpetrate great harm against women and children and seeing the child that they used to be. Not as a way of dismissing what they've done, and certainly it doesn't have an impact on my rage about it, but more, I guess, questioning, like, what were the steps between you as a four-year-old and you as a man who's making these choices now? Mm. Because unlocking that is surely part of the key to real men's behavioural change. Mm. It's not. It's funny because people will say, well, you just demonise men, etc., etc. But actually I want, as you know, to dismantle all of the things that contribute to the creation of these
absolutely,
men.
Absolutely, totally. And I'm actually reminded of a Buffy quote there where she's talking about where she's talking about typical teenage boys, and Xander says, you're jumping to conclusions. And she says, I didn't jump, I took a tiny step, and their conclusions were, which I love that. Because, yeah, it kind of relates to that. But I don't necessarily think of them as children. I definitely did have a time when that happened after I had my daughter, of starting to see these really harmed people who I was working with, victim survivors, and seeing them as children, which was a little bit of a different angle for me, a new way of looking at things. But what I do have, and I don't know if it's empathy or just an understanding of, is the shame that you have to work through in order to change. Mm. And I relate to that as a white woman in terms of my own anti-racist work, or, you know, focusing on, you know, becoming or understanding what intersectionality means in my life and what marginalized communities need from me. And so really thinking about the shame that I've had to work through, which is the only way through. Like, you have to work through that shame. And so shame is a very powerful motivator for not changing, but it's also really important information about my own humanity. And that's what I think about perpetrators. If they've got shame because of what they've done, that's good, because that tells us that he's stepped outside of his values. And part of the work that we can do is bring him back to those. And those values are the sort of values that we all share as humans.
Mm. Mm. I think that people, I mean, Jess Hill writes about shame and its connection with male perpetrators of violence, but I think not enough people make that acknowledgement that you have made about the shame in ourselves and not running away from it, but not allowing it to, not allowing the shame that we feel to stoke that indignation that is the natural response to it, or is the response that we allow to be the natural response, you know, to be indignant about how dare you make me feel the shame. And I relate to that as well, you know, in terms of my own kind of exploration of racism and anti-racism and,
the acknowledgement. I had a conversation with a friend yesterday, a gay man who has some experience of being marginalized, even though he's a white man, he's got lots of privileges. He's got some experience of being marginalized within masculinity. And we were talking about that resistance that so many men have to having conversations about sexism and misogyny and, you know, Christian, the Attorney General.
Yes.
You know, and Brittany Higgins and the response to all of this stuff that's happening in the country right now and has been happening, obviously, as we know, since time began. That this resistance to even having the dialogue about it comes from this place of, I mean, people, men saying, well, I'm not sexist, therefore that's the end of it. Mm. You know, well, firstly, you are. You are sexist. We're all sexist. Mm. We're all racist. You know, we're all conditioned by the system that we have been born into, the system that requires our allegiance in order to survive, and for men in particular, requires a particular kind of allegiance from you. You are sexist. Mm. So work with that and wake up every day and think to yourself, how am I not going to be sexist today? How will I actively resist that in myself? And as you said, you know, same goes for white people who absolutely 100% are beneficiaries of racism and white supremacy.
Yep. For sure. So I have a friend actually who, you know, through he was my co-facilitator in Men's Behaviour Change, and he established a group of men working on male entitlement and working through their own privilege, and they come together once a month to talk about that. And actually, they started reading your book, your first book, as part of that process, because they started doing this thing, I think, where they wanted to talk to the women in their lives. And I was like, no, don't do that. Mm. Read this book instead of, you know, getting women to do emotional labor for you, because, you know, the work is there. And they've been going for, I think, 5 years now, and they meet monthly, and it's excellent interrogating work, and they allow anyone to attend, which is really fabulous. But it's a really impressive and very brave space, I think, that Anthony has established in doing that work, and that commitment is clear. But he also says it's incredibly difficult to stay on top of, because it's so ingrained, and it would be so easy to stop, and nobody would think badly of him if he did.
I think that's, you know, if we heard of more men doing things like that. It's funny because, you know, the concept, I talk a lot about how patriarchy bonds men together, and it relies on men's allegiance to each other as well in order to survive, at the same time as it separates women from one another and relies on our separation in order for us to be complicit in the system, right? And sometimes when I talk about that and I say, you know, I talk about male bonding and the toxic elements and aspects of male bonding, people's immediate response is, you know, again, it's probably one of shame, but also resistance, that, well, what, don't you think that men should spend time together? You know, well, this is just men being friends, or, you know, well, we talk about mental health in these spaces. You know, always that one is a response to, you know, any critique of like Facebook groups that trade in horrendous misogyny and rape jokes and domestic abuse jokes. Always the response to any critique will be, well, but these spaces are also doing amazing things for men discussing their mental health. And it's like, why does that have to come at the expense of women's mental health? Mm. How are we in a space where male bonding is not actually about vulnerability and opening themselves up to one another, but about codifying masculinity together in order to have some semblance of brotherhood?
Yeah, they're really scary echo chambers. And that group, Dads in Distress, started out as an anti-suicide group for men who'd lost their children through the family court. And so it started out with these great intentions, but then, of course, turned into a men's rights group. Mm. So these spaces, if they're not informed and driven by some really strong values, and ideally those values would be feminist, then they're just at risk of becoming spaces where misogyny is just right. And same with the incel movement, didn't start out that way. And so, yeah, there's real danger in those spaces. They need to be, you know, and I think the way that we do men's behaviour change is we're so focused on accountability of the perpetrators, but also accountability to our, of ourselves as facilitators. And so for that reason, the model requires that we have observers in those groups. And so for myself and Anthony, every week that we ran a group, which was, you know, for many, many years, we would have at least, well, we'd have two observers every week. So they'd come and they'd watch us do the work, and it kept us accountable. So we're accountable to the victim survivors, but we also need to be accountable to the community.
Yep.
And so for Anthony, when he established this men's entitlement check-in group, you know, inviting people to come along and either participate or observe, you know, women in particular, that was making it clear that they were invested in accountability. And without that, then there's too much risk.
Mm. Why is it so difficult for people to be accountable in that way? I mean, I know the answer, but...
Yeah. Oh, I just think...
How arrogant was that? I know the answer. I think I know the answer. Mm.
I think there's lots of answers to that, really. I think it's really complex. I think shame comes into it again. I think people, you know, accountability requires us to face ourselves and to face others. It's more work to be accountable. It's more effort. Like, even in the groups that I was running, when we would have observers, it was... You know, we'd debrief them for an hour and then we'd debrief ourselves and then we'd write our notes and then we'd be leaving at 10 o'clock, you know, which was, you know, the group finished at 8. And so it would be an enormous amount of extra work just actually. I just think accountability, you know, I think of accountability as a gift. I think it's incredibly important, but we need to invite people into it, not force it on them, because that's power over. And we just can't use power in that way. It's not okay. It's part of the problem.
And what, I mean, it's that, it's, you think about things like the respectful relationships training, and, you know, that people want to give to teenagers because apparently before they're teenagers, you can't talk to them about these things, which is just, you know, the conservative upholding of, you know, protecting, so quote unquote, protecting our children from these frightening concepts of consent and respect is so terrifying. What needs to happen? Like, what to you, if you could radically overhaul the school system, you know, the community kind of the community values that we are conditioned into, what would your utopia look like?
Mm. Jeez, that's a good question. Well, my daughter went to a primary school where they did respectful relationships education, and I went in and observed one day, and it was wonderful. So it was just through the Department of Education, but it's fabulous. And I know some of the people who established that program in the first place, and they absolutely know what they're doing.
But not all primary schools offer it, do they?
No. Well, that would be the thing. Like, it would actually need to be consistent right across the entire education system, but it also needs to start really young. Mm. It needs to start in daycare. It needs to be everywhere throughout our system. But in order for that to be effective and for it to be authentic, then they need to be paying the carers and the teachers more. They need to be resourcing the Department of Education, you know, where they've got more than one worker per region. There needs to be an entire army. And teachers need to have mandatory training in, you know, responding to not only violence in the home, but also sexism, misogyny, racism, ableism, any sort of discrimination that children enact in the school. Because whilst we can't speak to that child's intentions, what we do know is the incredibly harmful impact of that behaviour. And so so many solutions to the world's problem come back to resourcing, and the resourcing is there. It just needs to be redistributed.
Mm. So true what you say about paying people properly as well. You know, I was thinking, my son's kinder actually had their getting to know you picnic last night. It was meant to be held a few weeks ago, but we had the snap 5-day lockdown, so that's why it's so late in the year. Even though it's March, but it does feel like the year is marching on.
Yes.
Anyway, I was there, I was chatting to his educators last night, who are all incredible, amazing people, and obviously not paid anywhere near enough, because the value that is placed on childcare, because it's a feminized industry, is basically nil. And we were talking about the march that's happening on Monday. You know, for anyone who's listening who hasn't heard, there's a march for justice that is a response really to everything that's going on in Australian Parliament right now. And it occurred to me, and obviously this is going to sound incredibly ignorant, because of course this would be the case, but I was suddenly met, obviously, by being surrounded by these educators. They can't just... You know, some of the most disenfranchised industries in the country, and they can't obviously just walk out and go on a march.
Yeah, because it's on a Monday.
Yeah, because and, yeah. But I can because they're looking after my kid, you know. So again, yeah. It's like working through that shame of privilege and what are you going to do about it? You know, what I was sitting there and I was thinking, well, I can't just feel bad about it. Like, what purpose does that serve? So what can we do about it? You know, I don't have the answer, but.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a lot of people who wouldn't be able to go to it. Like, I can't go because I am also working. And often my organization, so I work at Women's Health in the North, which is a glorious, wonderful place to work with a really supportive CEO and management. There's only like 20 of us. We're really little. But we also, because there's so few of us, the work that we do is really noticeable. And so it's would be really difficult if we stopped working on such short notice, because I know I said to you earlier, I didn't even know about the march until yesterday. So many things on a Monday that if I tried to reschedule them, it would just completely blow out so much. It's terrible. We'll have to think about other ways that we can be involved, and whether that's a social media campaign.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, one of the things that COVID has done is highlight, obviously, what many people knew to be true already, which is, you know, the extreme marginalisation of women in particular in low-paid industries.
Yeah.
And also the essential nature of their work. So essential workers being basically shat on by economics.
Yeah.
That's an interesting segue, though. As a family violence prevention worker, what are your observations? Because we did talk last year, we did an Instagram Live after the lockdown started, and we talked a little bit about the impact of lockdown on people who are experiencing family violence. What have been some of the things that you've observed in that as we're coming up to, you know, the anniversary of lockdown?
Yeah, it was really interesting because the sector braced itself and looked at starting to shift workers around to move them into sort of the crisis response end to be able to respond to this enormous demand that just didn't come. And the reason for that, which is no surprise at all, is because, you know, victim survivors couldn't make a phone call because the perpetrators were there. And so what that did was that it removed what we call protective factors from the victim survivors. And so they had to endure, you know, more abuse and violence and monitoring from the perpetrators because they just couldn't get out. And services adapted so beautifully. They set up, you know, email addresses, web chats. They, you know, got really, really good at secret phone calls and, you know, which was so incredible. And all of this, you know, family violence workers were in their homes and doing this incredibly high-risk work. And, you know, I have a private practice where I do clinical supervision for family violence workers, for family violence specialists, and a lot of them were doing, you know, some of them were doing men's behaviour change groups from their home via Zoom. Some of them were doing crisis response and triage from their kitchen table while their kids were being homeschooled in the other room. And it was just remarkable. The organisations were working really hard on, you know, really focusing on sustainability in order to retain the specialised workforce. You know, I don't know. I mean, it was just incredibly remarkable across the board. When the restrictions began to ease, then the calls started to come and the busy sector got busier. And so they were able to, you know, respond in a way that they were waiting to for all that time. Yeah. But just, you know, having... Because one of the high-risk factors in family violence, and we talk about high-risk factors as high risk for homicide or serious injury or induced disability, one of the major ones is unemployment for the perpetrator. And that's not because of financial stress, because family violence is not a class issue, but it's just simply because he's around more. And he's around more to monitor, to abuse, to control. And it removes those protective factors, as I said, into, you know, like the victim survivors just can't have a break, they can't make a call, and they get quite stuck.
I remember reading a few years ago about the impact of natural disasters on family violence as well and on domestic abuse. And obviously it makes sense, but I don't think enough people realise that link. Mm. And one of the things, so after Black Saturday, family violence reporting rates skyrocketed in Australia after the Christchurch earthquake. Mm-hmm. The same thing happened. The link between increased reports of domestic abuse and natural disasters and also sporting matches mm-hmm. is clear. Mm. One of the problems, though, with natural disasters, and COVID obviously would fall into this mm-hmm. category, is that there is a rush from people to empathise is the wrong word, but to
excuse,
yeah, because the men are really struggling.
Mm-hmm.
The men were really struggling when, not to diminish at all the impact of bushfires, but why is it that women and children are always seen as the collateral damage mm. of men's emotional mm. well-being or distress?
Mm. So one of my colleagues, Deb Parkinson, actually did research into the Black Saturday bushfires as part of her work with what's called the Gender and Disaster Pod. And so it's a consortium of emergency services, family violence services and researchers. And what they found was there's the connection between masculinity and violence was there. Mm. And so what was going on during the Black Saturday bushfires is that men were protecting the properties, protecting the community, and the women were protecting the children, the animals, and leaving. And so one of the things that I often think about when talking about disasters is my friend was working at Safe Steps that night, which is the 24-hour central access point to victim survivors, to refuge and safe houses. And she got a call from a woman who said, my husband left and he left me here to burn. And that was this this massive turning point for all of us, I think, in thinking about the ways in which perpetrators will use those disasters to further harm. Mm. And so that's absolutely one of the things that we saw was the violence was already there. It was just, it is because there was now more opportunity to harm. But the thing that Jan said was, there's so many awards for men's bravery in bushfires, but there's no awards for the sort of brave that women are. Mm. And if you think about what it would mean to, it's again kind of that idea that the ways in which we don't place value on women or femininity, can't say that word, and, like the amount of courage it takes to get all your kids, the animals.
Absolutely.
And that's remarkably brave. Staying and fighting is remarkably brave, but part of the problem was that men were offered support afterwards and a majority of them didn't take it up mm. because of masculinity and because of gender role expectations. They thought they could handle it themselves and they couldn't because they're humans and humans can't handle that themselves. They need support. Mm. And so it wasn't their distress that caused the violence, it was their masculinity.
I agree completely about the notion of, no one recognising the courage and bravery that women summon every day mm. in the face of these things, not just in natural disasters, but in the face of just surviving the world that mm. we live in. I think I've talked to you before about how powerful it would be if we had, in the same way that there are war memorials fucking everywhere,
mm.
if we had a memorial to women.
Mm.
We had a memorial to all of the women in Australia who've, you couldn't name all of them,
mm.
but just a symbolic place that acknowledged
yeah.
the loss,
mm.
And obviously also celebration of, women who've endured and survived and
yeah,
achieved.
But, of course.
A monument to what we've lost.
Mm.
How many bloody avenues of remembrance do we need to have? And that's the other thing as well. When International Women's Day rolls around and men everywhere are always like, well, why do we bloody need an International Women's Day? This is sexist. and sneering at the idea, even if, because a lot of women don't know the history of International Women's Day. And for anyone who's listening to this who doesn't know, and if you use Instagram, I've got a highlight on there where I, I look at how it, you know, was born out of the socialist labor movement. It was obviously created by women, but incredible working class women who were activists, who were fighting for change, for, you know, for other women who were working in the trenches of the system. But even leaving that aside, even if you didn't know that history, the fact that, you know, men will often say, well, why do we need an International Women's Day? And women will respond saying, well, because we need to acknowledge gender inequality and all of the things that women still endure. And that's not enough either, you know. But how is it different to any other historical day? That's the thing. I feel like people are always looking for, well, what can I say to this person to win the argument, or what can I say to get them to be quiet? And maybe that's all we need to say. Well, it's an historical day. It's a day that has historical significance to women in the labor movement, and we celebrate it in exactly the same way that we celebrate Labor Day, in exactly the same way that we acknowledge Anzac Day. It is a day that has symbolic meaning, and that's all that it. If that's all that it has to be to you, then that's fine. Of course, that won't. You know, they'll still find a way to shit on it.
Of course, absolutely, because they're not talking about the day, they're talking about women. It's absolute gaslighting, isn't it? Just it's crazy making, and it takes up so much effort and so much time, and it's exhausting. And it's like this epic deflection from the men's movement.
Well, that's why I always say to women, just stop, you know, resist the urge to respond. We don't owe it to men to convince them, particularly not when they come to us in bad faith.
Absolutely.
There's, as you said before, there's enough work out there that if they're truly interested, like men coming to me and demanding a conversation, well, if you really cared about it, then you'd debate me. Like, dude, I've written two books about this and hundreds and thousands of article words. Like, you can go and fucking learn about it yourself, but you won't. So I don't owe you anything. I think that that's a really – that's a something that it takes quite a while to come to, because we feel like if we don't give them the conversation that we've lost in some way, we've failed. But it's not – the success of the feminist movement doesn't rest on the shoulders of one woman being able to convince Barry that, you know, gender inequality is real. So just don't give them, and that will infuriate them more than anything, because they want to engage you, they want to laugh at you, they want to mock you,
they want
to
feel superior, as well.
And as you get more and more upset, they will thrive on that, you know. But just saying to them, I don't owe you anything. Go and read about it. It's fine if you don't believe it. It doesn't make it not true.
It's interesting, because I guess just coming to talking about Joss Whedon and really, you know, sort of seeing the ways in which different people have responded to it, that there was so much gaslighting that took place in there. And
Just give a little background for people who aren't familiar with what's happened with Buffy.
I know. I forget that people aren't obsessed with Buffy and don't focus on everything that is Buffy. So Charisma Carpenter, who played Cordelia Chase in both Buffy and Angel, so as part of what we'll call the Buffyverse or the Whedonverse, which we don't call it that anymore.
And let's just also say for younger listeners that Buffy was a television show that debuted in the late 90s. It was about a girl, Buffy Summers, who was sort of like the quintessential blonde final, not final girl. She would be the first person to die in any horror movie.
Exactly.
But she was part of the legacy of the Slayers. So one girl given powers on her 16th birthday to fight all of the demons and monsters in the world. I mean, it's a brilliant feminist origin story.
It's a great concept.
And it speaks to a lot of women in particular.
It really does. And I think that it also, you know, there's a lot of sci-fi nerds that came on board with it as well, and just like it kind of spanned across a number of different subcultures. I loved it because I think it was the first thing that I found funny. Like when I found Buffy, I was like, oh my God, this is my humor. This is so good. I just loved it. And then it appealed to me on so many levels. But Joss Whedon, who created it, who we have loved for many, many years, you know, many people have spoken out about him being very toxic, very harmful, very abusive and predatory. And there's a number of people who have spoken out, and one most recently is Cordelia – her name's Charisma Carpenter, Cordelia Chase, who played this amazing sort of badass kind of a bully at first, but, you know, the popular girl at Sunnydale High. And she spoke out about the ways in which she was treated and targeted specifically by Joss and his nasty behaviours and his sort of, you know, very entitled, mean, superior, you know, behaviours. In particular, targeting her about her weight during her pregnancy and then wrote her off the show with a ridiculous storyline that actually a lot of people kind of tuned out when that happened.
That was when he did the Angel crossover, so that wasn't in Buffy.
That was in Angel, yeah. And so I know I'm assuming people have so much knowledge here, aren't I? It's terrible. Anyway, if you've not watched Buffy, it's on Stan.
The point is that it is one of those shows where, I mean, Joss's behaviour aside, Joss is gross and
totally
definitely well overdue to be cancelled.
But also, and so we wouldn't need to cancel people if they were freaking accountable, and he just hasn't been. He's said nothing about this except that he denies it.
Yeah, like so many men in positions like that, you know, regardless of the industry. That aside, there are things, you know, when you go back to a show that was created in the late 90s, there's always going to be things that become glaringly problematic when viewed through a 2021 lens, just as things that are made now will seem that way in 20 years' time. Mm-hmm. So I don't think either of us are sitting here and saying, well, if it weren't for Joss being a predator, this is a perfect show. It's, nothing's perfect, but it does have – it was the first mainstream, you know – at the time it launched, it was this. There was no streaming or anything like that. You watched TV week to week.
Oh my God, with ads.
Yeah, and that it was the horrific. First. It was the first TV show that our generation of women had, where we saw us being given powers.
Mm.
You know, and yes, I know Charmed came later, but it was shortly afterwards. But it was the first one where the weak or the girl that would have always been presented as weak and also frivolous, girly, like Buffy loves heels, she loves pink, that kind of girl is given the power to fight the demons, which so often in the universe are really just metaphors for misogyny.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And so there a number of people from Buffy and Angel, a number of the actors put their support behind Charisma. Nicholas Brandon, who played Xander, was a rambling weirdo who actually just said, you know, my experience with Joss was complicated, but, you know, it was kind of okay. And, you know, there's always toxic stuff on film sets. And Anthony Stewart had kind of said similar things. Like his response was a little bit. I just don't think he was prepared for the question in the interview that I watched. And it wasn't a great response. Some people have not responded at all, including Alison Hannigan, who played Willow, and Christine Sutherland, who played Buffy's mum. And they've been called out for not speaking out, but we also – I think it's important to let people speak out in their own time and to also not assume that they've not had their own experiences. Or, you know, if they – or that it's very complicated to speak – you know, because they all have their own relationships with him, which could also be that they're, you know, choosing his side, which is
– Well, the thing is I feel – personally, I clocked that Alison Hannigan hadn't said anything or hadn't offered Charisma Carpenter support and hadn't offered her support. And my gut instinct is to be furious about that and to judge Alison Hannigan for it. And maybe that's the correct response. But it is interesting that that expectation is given more strongly to women 100%. When they are more likely to be hurt by speaking out.
Yep. Absolutely.
Which is not – I mean, Alison Hannigan still has an enormous amount of power, so I'm not defending her or saying, you know, that she potentially is, like, going to be harmed if she talks. I think, honestly, my personal assumption is that she's actually just taking Joss Whedon's side. Yeah. I feel – I get a kind of company girl vibe from her and a not like other girls vibe too.
God. But it's also that thing about, you know, Joss Whedon has enormous power. You know, he obviously worked on a lot of the Marvel films, which is like the whole world right now. He actually did some terrible things on Marvel, like with Hawkeye's character. He gave him a secret wife and children living in isolation in the countryside. And the woman, the wife who's pregnant with a bunch of children, saying to him, go off and be a hero. Mm. I support you. And it's like, holy shit, Joss, is this your fantasy?
It totally is. That is 100% how he sees himself, you know.
So disgusting. And it actually ruined the film and Hawkeye and in the comics. I'm not actually a comic nerd, but my partner is. And, you know, they've really reported that in the comics, Hawkeye lived alone in an apartment in New York. So why change him? Why change Hawkeye if not to just give us this idea of an idealized woman who is just, you know, just supporting you to go off and do your thing while they raise your brood? It's foul. And absolutely, it was that moment for me. I was like, holy shit, we got to kill our idols, man. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not okay. We've got to stop thinking in Joss we trust, because we cannot trust him.
Well, I think that he will, you know, struggle to ever come back from this, and nor should he come back from it, to be honest.
I hope so. And I think that, you know, like historically.
Nor should he, because it's been so long. Yeah. Even if he were to, you know, really do that inner work and become accountable. Mm. It's just been too long of him refusing it.
And there's zero evidence that he will do that unless it's for his own benefit.
So I get asked this question a lot too, and my response is always, I think it depends on how much you like the art, to be honest, which is a very tongue-in-cheek response. But people say, like, can you still enjoy these things when the person who made them is fucked up? Mm. What point do you separate the art from the artist?
Mm. Yeah. I mean,
can you still watch Buffy?
Absolutely, I can. And because I'm really conscious of all of the other people that worked on it. And, you know, some of my favorite writers, like Jane Espenson, you know, on that show, and plus the effort that all of the actors have put into it. And what it means for me, like, I know, you know, like when I was in my early 20s, which was over 20 years ago, where I would watch Buffy on video. I had the VHS, I had all the videos, and I would watch them every single night, and it got me through my 20s, which were grim, you know, in lots of wonderful, but also, you know, they were my 20s. Exactly. And it was everything to me, and it's mine, you know, it's not Joss's. And I'm really reminded, as you say, that of, you know, Anita Sarkeesian, who's a pop culture feminist, wonderful human, who says it's okay to like something and be critical of it. Mm. And so, you know, as you say, with Buffy, there's so many things about it that it would be done quite differently now. Like, there's, I think, maybe 4 or 5 black actors throughout the entire series, which is surely unacceptable even by 90s standards. But, it, you know, like, understanding, I don't know, still being able to love it and be critical of it is kind of part of that.
Mm.
And thinking critically is incredibly important. And if we cancelled everything that we loved, we might not be left with much, because there's this thing, you know, when Joss's ex-partner spoke out about his abuse of her in their relationship and his emotional abuse and abandonment, I remember sitting there and thinking, I'm not surprised and I will never be surprised, but this, you know, because it's a reminder that as soon as we idolize somebody, we're at risk of being hurt by their shitty behavior. And I remember thinking this, you know, like as a teenager and all the way through the 90s, like being really into punk music and then meeting the guys from those bands, and they were absolute douchebags, or that they'd like sleep with their fans and just completely inappropriate. And I learned pretty quickly that as soon as you meet the people that, you know, who do the art that you like, the art's ruined. And so it is kind of better to, I don't know the answer to your question.
I know what you mean. Well, that's why I say that, you know, I tongue-in-cheek my response is how much you like the art.
I know.
Because I don't like Woody Allen's movies anyway, but because I quite freely take the stance, no watching Woody Allen.
Yes.
I mean, the thing is, maybe it's a case as well of like past versus present. Mm. You know, would I watch a show that Joss created now? Probably I wouldn't support it.
Mm.
if it's already been made, does that make it different somehow? I mean, it is one of those like curly questions where...
But also... There's definitely
The answer should also just be that there's just been too many fucking white men making too much art through history.
100%. So, because what I was going to just say there was maybe it's not just making this thing that we're enjoying now, but it's possibly some other perpetrator.
Mm.
And somewhere along the line, somebody who is deeply sexist and racist and harmful is making our content. And it's incredibly difficult to not...
Mm. And the more, as with Joss, the more they surround themselves in this sort of like feminist persona, you know, the more likely it seems to me, or well, not the more likely, but the more we should be aware of the possibility that they're hiding in plain sight.
100%.
You know, the number of men who've aligned themselves with feminist causes and are abusing women behind the scenes. And also because men are rewarded for being feminists in a way that women aren't. I know.
Absolutely.
Like, that's why I hate that narrative that, you know, men should be feminists because women want to sleep with feminist men. It's like, that should not be the reason that men are feminists, but feminist men can get laid.
But feminist men are more likely to be slept with, whereas nobody's ever tried to hook up with me no. because I'm a feminist.
No.
In fact, the opposite has happened more than once.
Yeah, yeah. Like the idea that somehow, well, it's the same with, you know, I'm sure that Joss got attention from a lot of very beautiful women because the persona that gets to be created around a man like that is very appealing. Mm. And the way that we reward men in our society is through giving them our attention and, you know, having sex with them. Mm. And wanting to be aligned with them for our own, for the reputation that we then get, because the only positive reinforcement that one of the ways that women can get positive reinforcement
totally. Is male gaze.
Male gaze, yeah. And this, I'm attached to this man, therefore that reflects on me. Mm. Yeah, like certainly very few men have been drawn to me because I'm a feminist. And if they are, I'm always very suspicious.
Yeah.
You know, what are you trying to get out of being aligned with me? Mm. I also think as well, just sort of deviating a little bit into internet dating and stuff, I always think, what would your ex-girlfriend think if we started to date? What would your ex-girlfriend think of that? Would she be angry about it? Would she be pissed off that you get to like be after what happened with you and her? I mean, it's all those questions that I find it impossible not to think about.
Like, did she do all the work to get him woke to then be someone who you'd hook up with?
You know, then I've had men who I've gone on one date with and not even kissed. It's filtered back to me that they've told other women, oh, yeah, we dated.
Mm.
No, we didn't.
Mm.
We didn't. Don't use me to make yourself more appealing to this woman or to make yourself seem safe to her.
Yeah.
I remember a guy came up to me in the airport once before COVID, obviously, when we could still travel. And he said, oh, I'm a huge fan. And he was there with a female friend and he introduced me to her and he said, I'm a huge fan. Can we take a photo? And I said, yeah, sure, of course. Took a photo with him. Weirdly, I mean, he told me that they were on their way to Canberra. They were going to a gig or something like that. And weirdly, the next day, someone messaged me from Canberra, a woman, and said, oh, this guy's Tinder profile has just popped up. Do you know him? Because his caption on his profile was, I mean, it was the picture of me and him.
Oh, whoa.
And the caption was, and it wasn't the name that he'd given me either. The caption was, in Canberra for 24 hours, wanna fuck? ? Which, fine, like, I don't have a problem with someone going to Canberra and being like, I'm here for 24 hours, want to get together and bone.
Such a brutal way to ask it.
Yeah. I did have a huge problem with the fact that that was my fucking photograph
why
on
there.
Why
did you do that?
I think,
I mean, I know why, of course.
Makes it seem like,
oh my God,
he's a feminist, he's safe, might make it seem like we're friends because I was smiling and, you know, had our arms around each other. Anyway, I posted it on Twitter and I said, I did him the service of covering his face because I gave him the benefit of the doubt that maybe he didn't know that that was a wrong thing to do, which was very generous of me, I will say. And I posted it on Twitter and I said, I don't know this guy. If you see this profile, I am not endorsing him. This is gross. I find this disgusting. Don't swipe on him, basically. And he emailed me And he said, oh, my friend saw your tweet. That I didn't post that. You know, I'm so sorry that this has happened. I posted the photograph of you and me on my Facebook and it was public and someone stole it and created this profile for me. And, you know, I had nothing to do with it. I feel terrible. And I just wrote back to him and I was like, stop.
Mm.
At least do me the decency of not fucking lying to me.
Yeah.
You know, I know you did it. Apologize. Say that you didn't intend to make me feel this way and, you know, take it down. Like accountability, as you're saying. But he like made up this weird lie that makes no sense. I said to him, why would someone randomly in Canberra find your photograph of me and set you up like this? What to what purpose does that serve?
That's outrageous. The "it wasn't me" defense is never believable.
No. No. I mean, at least come up with a remotely convincing story.
I was hacked.
Yeah, or just yeah. Be accountable. Like honestly, if he'd written back and he'd said, "I'm so sorry. That was really gross. Absolutely. I wasn't thinking. I apologize. I've taken it down." And accept that then he will forever in my eyes be seen as disgusting. Mm. Accept it, you know. Accept that you did something wrong and apologize. And even if I'm still angry at you, that's fine. Mm. I'm entitled to be, you know. Yeah, it's just the lack of accountability for it.
It's such a good reminder, I think, about how we can absolutely do things differently because accountability is always, like, it can be harder and it might not come natural. Oh, dear.
Someone's here.
Well, someone's somewhere. Yeah, and it might not come naturally. It's something that we need to practice and get better at. And it can be very, very humbling. And not everybody likes that, especially if they're used to feeling superior. And so I guess in thinking about, you know, like the sorts of things that could – that really could make a difference in terms of how we experience men who are named as being abusers or named as being harmful, you know – it would make an enormous difference to the world if they just said, holy shit, yeah, I'm going to now go off and do some work and do better. And I'm sorry and I'm so sorry it's harmed you. I'll do better.
And accept as well that after that work is done, they may not return to the standing that they had.
But also that the work might be lifelong.
Yeah.
Because the socialization is deep, you know, just the same as it is with racism. Like we're not going to be posting a black square in our Instagram and suddenly we're not racist anymore.
No, that, but a lot of people think that that's all that it takes, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, but it's just not true.
Same with men. Men thinking that all that it takes for them to dismantle rape culture is to not personally rape a woman.
Is to be one of the good guys.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The race that people, you know, the speed with which people want to absolve and forgive the most powerful men in the world.
Yeah.
You know, remember when Louis C.K. was, you know, finally admitted to the truth of the rumors that he had spent years not even just denying but treating as beneath him, like not wouldn't even entertain them as being possible because he was a serious artist and so that's just below me. Then finally obviously had to admit it because, you know, the New York Times piece came out about him with all of these women naming him as an abuser. And I remember that he released that apology, quote unquote, apology letter where he mentioned at least four times how deeply all of these women admired him. And how he was deeply admired and how he had let down his fans who deeply admire him, etc. And not once said the word sorry in this apology letter. Not once did he say, I am sorry. He just sort of framed it in this like, I let people down, you know, I've got an addiction to masturbating in front of people kind of way.
Yeah, that's not a thing.
No, but I remember sharing it and going, fuck this guy, like this is shit. And someone responded to that saying, well, he said sorry, what more do you want?
Yeah, so I mean, sorry is a behaviour and it's the kind of thing that we talk about in men's behaviour change. It's like if you say sorry but it's inauthentic, it's just part of the abuse cycle and it's part of the ways in which you ensure that people are emotionally linked to you and it's nothing if it's not followed up with action.
I love that. You've said so many fucking nuggets today, like gold nuggets. Sorry is a behavior. Mm-hmm. It's not just a word.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've never heard it put like that before.
I think the same of love, actually, and we talk about that too in Men's Behavior Change, that love is a behavior. And, you know, if anybody is sort of sitting there questioning what these behaviors mean, if it doesn't feel like it comes from a place of love and respect, then it's possibly not coming from a place of love and respect and could be causing harm. And so we really need to think about actions and not just words, because words can really trap us. Mm-hmm. And a letter like that, that's just words.
Mm-hmm.
It's just him trying to get props and trying to get away with it.
I want to recap those three great things, those three great one-liners that you've said in the episode today. So the first was about, you know, we're planting seeds in a forest we may not get to spend time in. Ah, oh, it's so beautiful. So beautiful. Sorry is a behavior as well. And love is a behavior. Like, you think about actions instead of words. And what was the other one that you said something and I was like, that's...
Was it about the brick wall?
Yes.
Yeah, if you're going to bang your head against a brick wall, at least bang your head where there's a crack.
Oh, so good.
Yeah, and somebody also, because I've said that, I say that in my training actually, just to support workers to feel as though there is a way to work with people who are resistant. Mm. And somebody said recently, there's a song lyric, and it might be Leonard Cohen, you'll probably correct me, where he said, you know, if there's a, that the crack is where the light gets
in. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is no, that Leonard Cohen? Yeah, Cohen, cool, yeah. Good.
Yeah. Crack is where the light gets in.
Yeah, which I love. And yeah. So you think about accountability as that light and how we can sort of invite somebody into that light, which can make a big difference to their lives. Mm. And, of course, the lives of the people that love them and don't want to be harmed anymore.
I've loved talking to you in your kitchen.
Me
on
too.
This overcast Saturday morning. I'm sorry that I turned up in such a wretched state.
Not at all.
I feel like if I could broadcast you into everyone's living rooms every week, then I think that would be a very good thing. But you are thinking about making a podcast yourself.
Yeah, so I was thinking about doing a podcast about friendship with a friend of mine who has recently been diagnosed with ADHD, and just wanting to talk about our own experiences of friendship, but from a sort of neurotypical, neurodiverse perspective. Because, yeah, I just think it would be something really interesting to talk about what friendships mean, how they can hurt, about expectations and all sorts of things. Mm. So who knows if I'll do it, but it's such a different angle to what I normally think and talk about, you know, so it could be lovely.
And just quickly as well, before we wrap up, what things bring you joy?
So Buffy brings me joy, which, as I said, I spent so many years with Buffy in my life helping me through my daughter, my pets, my partner, and, you know, clothes, vintage clothes mostly, op shops.
Mm-hmm. They bring me joy too.
Oh, so much.
Your house brings me joy. You've got all these wonderful woolen wall hangings, vintage wall hangings, and they're bringing me a lot of joy right now.
Awesome.
And
me too.
All of the plants too. Mm. I'm just going to wrap up. I'm just wondering what I should pass on. Anyway, okay. Ada Conroy, it has been an absolute pleasure to speak to you. I love you. I love the work that you're doing. I'm so glad that we have people like you in the world and that you are in the world specifically as well. Thank you so much for spending this hour
Clementine.
With me.
It's a pleasure.
Remember, there's no topic too thorny and no question too weird for the Big Sister Hotline. We're here for all the questions you don't want to ask your therapist, especially now that it has to be over Zoom. So contact us instead. The Big Sister Hotline. The phone lines are open.
Thank you.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.